physical discomfort kept his mind in play, kept it from turning back to the strange jumble of his thoughts like a great unsifted junk heap where all things were wrong. The doctor, Francesca, Francesca Dickinson, Dickinson Joram, Helen, the doctor, the robbed grave, the blood on the floor. So he faced that wind gladly, and coming to a little eminence within sight of the high roof of the O'Malley house, he even stood still, letting that sharp wind like icy water drench him, blowing freely through his clothes. Now that he had left his post, perhaps they would not want him back. He would have to meet the sad eyes of Helen, conscious of death, conscious of the terror of this world. So he welcomed the cold and miserably set his teeth, for he would have given all his soul to be able to reduce this problem to one of physical force with which he could use his strength and grapple. He understood now why Hercules was enslaved, even to a woman, for might of hand goes in service always to the keener brain. So he, Weldon, was enslaved also, and bitterly he resented it. Through the dim pink of the growing dawn, he saw a rider come down out of the blackness of the pines, jogging a cow pony without haste, like a weary man who has journeyed all the night. Leaning against a poplar in the little nest of trees that sheltered him, Weldon watched the man with interest. The horse picked its own way, while the rider sat with bowed head that bounced with the loose jogging of the pony. Winding back and forth, never hunting for shortcuts, the pony came down the hill as though it were following the twistings of a trail, but there was no trail to follow. Very hungry and weary this man must be. He had been far away, dancing all night, perhaps, drinking moonshine whiskey, being very happy. Now he returned to pick up his work and go yawning and groaning through another day of labor. Ah, how much Weldon envied him, who had ridden so closely past the O'Malley house without any thought, doubtless, of the tragedy that endured in that unhappy place. The rider drew nearer. He seemed to sleep in the saddle, but as he came past, the stumble of the cow-pony made the man throw up his head a little, and Weldon saw the familiar face of that worthy young man who had been addressed as Slim on the day when the two of them had disappeared into the wall of the O'Malley house. He snapped out a revolver and fired inches before the face of the sleepy rider. Slim shouted in bewilderment. The pony shied, throwing his rider off balance, and before he could right himself, Weldon was stalking down from the trees with a leveled gun. Slim thrust his hands lazily into the air. He appeared rather disgusted than afraid. "You're a kind of standing crop around here, it looks to me," Weldon said. "What are you doing here now?"
"Riding herd," said the other, yawning. "What are you doing?"
"Watching the coyotes and the wolves," Weldon responded. "And I think that I have one now. Get off your horse and stand with your hands over your head and your face to the pony's shoulder." Slim sighed.
"You're going to fan me for my gun," he said. "All right. It's a little one in my right coat pocket. There's a pocket knife in the left trousers pocket. That's all."
He slid down from his horse and stood obediently in the required position, yawning again. Quickly, Weldon found the indicated weapons. He patted the body of the other from head to foot. There were no more guns, but a fat wallet came presently into his hand.
"Leave that be, will you?" Slim sighed. "I worked fair and honest for that."
"What did you do for it?" asked Weldon.
"What business is that of yours?" Slim asked,
anger mastering his weariness. He made as if to turn, and Weldon took him by the nape of the neck.
"Listen to me, old son," said Weldon. "I never was a patient man, and what little patience I had is all used up now. All gone, in fact. I want you to pay attention to me. Whatever you have in your mind about the O'Malley house, out with it, and tell me a straight story."
"That's a fine idea," the other said with a sardonic chuckle. "You want me to give evidence against myself, eh? Look here, Weldon, I'm not such a fool."
"Don't say no to me," Weldon answered gently. "Think this thing over for 10 seconds, and change your mind about talking, or else I'll break you up fine. Break you up so small, my boy, that people will be able to pass you in bright daylight and not know that you're a man." He whirled the other around as he spoke, and let Slim have a look at his face. It was worth seeing at this moment. Slim nodded. "All right," he said with wonderful coolness and cheerfulness. "I'll talk, Turkey. Where do I begin? And how does it come that you're double-crossing the little girl in the house yonder?" That remark, with all it suggested, brought a bull-like bellow from Weldon. And Slim went on, "Well, well, I'll talk. Only where do I begin?" "With the beginning." "All right, all right. Keep yourself from falling apart, will you? And I'll talk fast enough. The Negro woman got me."
"Aunt Maggie?"
"That's her. She said that her lady wanted a couple of good men. She came to me."
"How did she hear of you?" Weldon asked.
"I ain't unknown," Slim said, and nodded with some satisfaction. "Go on, then." "I went up to the house with a pal. A weak sister, he turned out. Anyway, Aunt Maggie showed us into the house."
"How?"
"Through a neat little door in the wall of the place."
"Ah," Weldon murmured, satisfied that he was hearing the truth.
"And then?"
"We went up and seen Miss Helen. She wanted us."
He paused and frowned.
"Go on," urged Weldon.
"To do a job of body snatching."
Weldon, stunned, said not a word.
"I felt the same way," said the other, "particular when I found out that it was the body of her old man that she wanted moved. But anyway, the pay was good that she offered, and we took the body away."
"What did you do with it?"
"Put it in a buckboard and carted it clean across the hills to Busby. And there, turned it over to Dr. Martin."
"Go on. What next?"
"Came back to get paid with Martin's note, saying that he'd received the body, and when we got to the house, you was waiting. I thought at first that you had been posted by the girl to beat us out of the payment. But afterward I remembered that she'd warned us particular not to be seen by you, or trouble would pop."
"She don't like you much, does she?"
Slim suggested with a malicious grin. Weldon turned a dark red.
"And after that," went on Slim, "we got away. My partner with his hand cut by your bullet. A pretty neat snapshot, I called that. Anyway, we faded through the wall and got up to her room. There she paid on the nail. We wouldn't go back the way that we came, because I had an idea that you'd be watching on the trail. So we went out through another room and right out the rear door of the house through the patio. Before I went, though, she promised me another 100 if I'd go back to Martin and bring her a note that Martin would have ready for her. I done that. I got the note."
"What was in it?"
"I don't know. It was sealed."
Weldon hesitated.
"What were you paid?"
1,000 cold for the first job. I got 500 out of it. 100 for this ride. And I'm dead fagged. There's the money. Count it for yourself."
But Weldon did not count. He stared at the face of Slim and told himself that the man was honest. He had told the truth.
"Here's the wallet. Climb on your horse and get out of this," advised Weldon.
He tossed back the wallet. He even threw the gun and knife at the feet of Slim and watched the latter put away the weapons and climb into the saddle.
"They must pay you pretty big," Slim said, "to make you hang around to spy on a poor girl like her. What's she ever done to you, Weldon?"
With this parting comment, he jogged the tired pony again. Helen O'Malik, Helen the tender and the fair, to whom he had not dared reveal that the body was missing. It was she who had done the thing. He went up the hill in grim silence. The sun rose as he came to the patio entrance, and he saw Aunt Maggie crossing the court with a bucket of milk.
"Back again, are you?" she called to him. "I never thought to see your face again."
He passed her in grim silence and entered the house. Chapter 40 The little brown-faced cat of Aunt Maggie met him on the stairs. It was a playful bit of a creature, not much more than a kitten, and because Weldon had given it some notice before, it now raced up the stairs with him, pretending to hide at every corner they passed. So he came to the library and threw it to his own room. There he paused, nerving himself, and he had to stare at the places on the floor where he had seen the spots of blood before he could compel himself onward. The little cat went before him and scratched at the door of the girl's room. He remembered then that some people feel sure that a cat can sense coming evil, and it gave him a slight shudder as he went to the door in turn and tapped against it. He heard the low, husky voice of Helen O'Malley answer, and he opened the door at once. Aunt Maggie had built a cheerful fire on the hearth at the side of the chamber, but since there was little light from the sun, Helen lay with her head toward the windows and a book in her hands. Always a book in those thin hands, so fragile and bluish-white. He went to the side of the bed, and her pathetic smile was turned up to him.
"I knew you'd come back, in spite of the doctor," she said.
"The doctor had his doubts, did he?" asked Weldon grimly.
She opened her eyes a little wider, observing his tone rather than his words, and it seemed to Weldon that she turned paler still as she watched him, frightened and expectant.
"Helen," he said, "when I came here I expected we would play with the cards on the table, you and I. It seems that you haven't been doing that. Mind you, I don't want to be brutal or harsh, but I have an idea that I ought to know what was in the letter that you received from Martin."
He watched her like a hawk to see the effect of shock, but apparently there was none whatever. She simply reached under her pillow and brought out a stiff, white envelope.
"After you read it, will you please put it in the fire?"
He took out the fold of paper and read rapidly, then over again twice to make sure of everything. "My dear Miss O'Malley, it was some time before I allowed my scruples to be overcome by your persuasion. There is a legal penalty for such a thing as you proposed to me, and while I did not doubt that you had sincere reasons for the suggestion, still I delayed, as you know, for what may have seemed to you an unreasonable length of time. However, the body was duly received from your two emissaries, and I made the examination that you suggested, trying to free my mind from every preconception that you had given me. It was impossible, however, to doubt. The very slightest examination convinced me. The internal organs were wonderfully preserved. That alone would have been almost enough proof. But then I made a chemical analysis that finally convinced me, and I have retained the specimens. There is no question that your unfortunate father died of arsenic poisoning. I am prepared to take the stand in any court and swear to that. Further details would be unpleasant for you to hear and unnecessary for me to relate at present. I retain the body. You will tell me how it must be disposed of. In the meantime, you will realize that I am troubled by the possession of it, and trust that you will plan its removal quickly. Faithfully yours, O. H. Martin, M.D. Weldon dropped the paper into the fire and watched it flame and die to a black cinder and then to a white fluff that finally blew up the chimney with the draft.
"You suspected it for a long time?" he asked finally. She nodded. "And you couldn't tell me?"
"No."
"You suspected also who had given the poison?"
"I knew who had given it."
"Who then?"
She shook her head.
"I can't tell you that."
"Is it someone I have met since I came here?"
"Yes."
He bit his lip. There were many possibilities, of course. Before he could ask another question, there was a knock at the door, and Aunt Maggie came in with a steaming cup of milk.
"This'll rest you and quiet you," she told the girl. "Let me see you drink it now, before I leave."
Helen O'Malley took the cup and saucer and touched the cup to her lips.
"It's too hot, Aunt Maggie. I'll drink it when it cools."
"And what about this Mr. Man?" said Aunt Maggie. "He gonna stay here with us again?"
"This is your busy time of day, Aunt Maggie," the girl said quietly. "You mustn't stay here to gossip. Of course Mr. Weldon stays with us."
She looked at him with a question, however, as Aunt Maggie left the room. "I don't know," Weldon muttered. "I stay if I'm needed. But you work without me. You leave me in the dark, and you seem perfectly able to get on without my help." She was perfectly calm, the husky voice barely audible as she answered,
"I haven't dared to tell a soul what was in my mind. I don't dare to tell everything still. I can only beg you to stay with me this last day. It's life or death for me. It's life or death for the murderer of my father. And I'm helpless to do anything unless you stay. Could you stay? Blindly, still, doing what I beg you to do?"
The answer was past his lips without his own volition. "I'll stay to the end," he said gravely. "This day is the last." She closed her eyes with a shudder, stroking the little brown-faced cat that had climbed onto the bed and now lay curled beside her, purring contentedly.
"They won't wait,"
Helen O'Malley said.
"They are clever, but they won't wait, I'm sure. There's too much at stake for them, and they'll strike quickly."
"That you?" She did not answer him directly.
"Look," she said, "it's starving, poor thing."
For the kitten was sniffing eagerly at the milk in the cup. Helen poured some into the saucer, and the cat drank it greedily. Still more, and still the kitten lapped. It sat back at last, curling its tail around its forepaws, licking the white from its whiskers, and half-closing its eyes in content. Helen O'Malley poised the cup at her lips. "Is that all you have for breakfast?" Weldon asked, scowling.
"It's all I need, and—"
The cat bounded down from the bed and ran across the floor to the door.
"It wants to get back to Aunt Maggie," Helen said. "Will you open the door for it?"
Weldon went at once to the door, but the kitten, with arched back and standing fur, struck and spat at him. "What's wrong with it?" he asked. There was an almost human cry of pain from the cat. It pressed close against the door, its back arched high, its belly drawn up. Helen O'Malley turned in the bed.
"The milk!" she cried suddenly. "It's the milk she drank here!"
And Weldon, drops standing cold on his forehead, realized that that was true. As for the brown-faced cat, its agony was not long. It whirled, as though seeking a place of escape. Then it leaped up to the nearest windowsill, scratched at the iron bars, and finally fell limp to the floor and remained still. It was dead, with a slight white froth at its lips.
"Aunt Maggie!" Weldon hissed. "I warned you about her before, and now she—"
"No, no!"
the girl answered in a voice suddenly harsh and ringing.
"She has nothing to do with it! Aunt Maggie! She's the one honest soul in the entire world! But the others, they—" "Call Aunt Maggie immediately," she went on.
Weldon went to the head of the stairs and called. Aunt Maggie's cheerful voice answered, and presently she came waddling up the stairs, heaving and panting.
Up and down all day," she complained. "I ain't one woman. I'm three in this here house, Mr. Weldon. Three women's work and one woman's pay. It ain't fair. I'm going to stop it."
And she went past him as he told her that her mistress wanted her at once. Weldon himself followed and reached the door in time to hear the cry of Aunt Maggie. The limp little body was in her big, strong hands as he came into the room.
"I gave it some of the milk,"
Helen said simply.
"The milk!" Aunt Maggie cried. "Oh, heaven forgive him!"
"Go to Dr. Watts,"
Helen O'Malley said.
"Go as fast as you can. Tell him that you gave me my morning milk, and that afterward I fell into a spasm and died, frothing at the mouth."
Aunt Maggie stood at the door, stricken with wonder.
"And tell Dr. Watts that Mr. Weldon came back this morning early, and I sent him away again because I was angry that he left the house last night."
Chapter 41 Aunt Maggie heard these strange directions with bulging eyes, and at the door, clinging to the jamb with both hands, she cried,
"And if you is dead, what? You saw me die, Aunt Maggie. I was in terrible convulsions. I sprang out of bed. I ran to the window and beat at the window bars. Then I dropped back and struggled once on the floor and was gone."
"Oh, heaven, forgive me,"
Aunt Maggie moaned, pressing a hand across her eyes.
"But I'm not dead after all, Aunt Maggie,"
Helen O'Malley said, smiling a little.
"No, no, honey, praise heaven,"
the woman said, somewhere between tears and laughter.
"You carried my dead body back to the bed, and you stretched it out here, and folded my hands across my breast, and closed my eyes, Aunt Maggie. Do you hear?"
"I hear you, honey," said the cook, blinking rapidly.
"And you've run all the way to the doctor's house, and you're barely able to talk. And when you talk, you scream. And when you scream, you weep. Do you hear me, Aunt Maggie?"
Gradually a smile dawned upon the woman's broad face and spread across it. It widened and grew richer. It shone like a light, and the bulging cheeks reduced her eyes to glittering points of light.
"I'm gone," she said,
and hurried from the room, and they heard her rapid footsteps pattering down the stairs, as though she really were prepared to run all the way to the house of good Dr. Watts. Helen O'Malley, in the meantime, looked after her with keen eyes, like the eyes of a man. Her face was tense but resolute, and her head was carried high. Weldon, almost past surprise, watched her carefully. He could hardly recognize in her the prostrate, relaxed invalid. Then she looked at him in turn, half frightened and half expectant. He merely shook his head. "You're an O'Malley," he said quietly. "Now what am I to do?" She half closed her eyes. He could see one hand. It was tightly clenched.
"Within an hour," she said, "there will be a door opened in that wall."
She pointed to the space between the two windows.
"Men are coming in. One man, surely. Probably two. Perhaps more. They are going to see that I am lying in this bed, with a sheet drawn over my head. The windows will be darkened so that they won't see any too clearly. But there will be enough light left for them to do what they have come to do, I think. You will be standing within the curtain that hangs over the closed door to my father's room. Can you stand there now without being seen?"
Without a word, he went to the curtain and passed behind it. It touched the floor, securely covering his feet.
"There's not a bulge," said the girl, "and your feet are covered completely. Now, with your knife, cut two or three small slits in the cloth so that you can look out and see everything that happens in the room."
He obeyed again, without pausing for questions.
"Can you see the wall and the bed?"
she asked. "I can see practically everything in the room."
"Come out again, then."
"Very well." He stood before her once more. He felt rather a fool, so completely in her hands, so utterly blindfolded as to the meaning of these maneuvers.
"You have your guns with you?"
"Yes."
"Let me see them."
Instantly they were in his hands, and then she nodded. Her lips were compressed, and yet there was something like a stern smile fighting for control of them.
"Those who come will be utterly desperate men, ready to kill without warning," she said. "Shoot them down as you would shoot down so many dogs."
"Without warning?"
"What warning did they give to me?" she asked. "They would have killed me this morning without more mercy than they would show to a beast."
Weldon dropped his head in thought. "I'll do what I can," he said calmly, "but I can't strike them without a warning. Even a rattler does that much. However, bullets will come fast on the heels of the first word. Will you trust to me?"
"You're right, and I'm brutal and wrong," the girl said. "Do as you wish."
Then she added,
"When did you last eat?"
"Yesterday. I forget when."
"Go down to the kitchen and make yourself a cup of coffee."
"I'd rather stay here."
"Do as I say. There's time for that. Drink a cup of coffee and eat some bread. Your hand will have to be steady afterward.
He knew that she was right, and in the silence that he had clung to, he obeyed, leaving the room and going straight down to the kitchen. There he found the fire humming as Aunt Maggie had left it. He put on the coffee pot with a liberal supply of ground coffee and a small amount of water. It boiled quickly, and sitting on the kitchen table, he looked out at the brightness of the day. For the sun was high now, the mountains gleamed with cheerful warmth. In the patio the bees were at work among the flowers, flying heavily from blossom to blossom, burdening themselves with pollen. He munched the heel of a loaf and drank a first and a second cup of coffee, unhurried. An hour, she had said. It did not occur to him that she could be wrong. Then he lit a cigarette, smoked it, and finally went up to her room. As he opened the door, the dimness of the room perplexed him. She had drawn the shutters. There was only a twilight in the place. Good for many purposes, perhaps, but very bad for straight shooting. Then he saw the girl, half sitting up in the bed, the covers flung over the foot of it, and only a white sheet drawn up to her shoulders. Her eyes were dark and great with fear and excitement, and as he would have spoken, she put a finger upon her lips and made a flashing gesture of her arm toward his place of concealment. He went to it with a gliding step, realizing that she must have heard some alarm in his absence. Ensconced behind the curtain, he looked out. The peepholes that he had cut, and that had seemed all sufficient while the room was flooded with the broad daylight, now gave him only dim glimpses. But by the first glance, he saw that the girl had lain down and drawn the sheet up over her head, and was now gradually working her hand down to her breast without disturbing the cloth. That movement barely had ceased when he heard a faint sound like the clicking of a well-oiled lock, and into the room yawned a whole section of the wall between the windows, swinging open without a whisper of noise. Weldon, guns in hand, set his teeth hard and cursed because his heart thundered. A very tall fellow stood in the dark mouth of the entrance. There was something familiar about his look in spite of the dimness of the light, and even though over his face a black mask was fitted, like an executioner, he came to the chamber. Presently, beside him, came a smaller man, masked also. But his beard was freely seen, and he panted audibly with effort. It was Dr. Henry Watts. The curve of his back and his whole build plainly identified him to Weldon. Watts, the good, the gentle, the wise. Watts, the friend of Francesca. Watts, the friend of delicate Helen O'Malley as well. It was a shock against which Weldon had to steady himself resolutely.
"Go take a look at her and pronounce her dead," the big man said in a very quiet voice.
"There's no need," Watts said. "A quarter of what she took this morning would have killed three people."
"I tell you," said the other, "I want to make sure of her before we move."
"Do it yourself, then," Watts said with a touch of irritation. "Examine her if you wish to. But heaven forgive me if I can look at her face again."
"The clever little panther," the big man said. "She had even you half under her thumb, you old fool."
"Perhaps I'm a fool. She trusted me, as you know."
"Trusted you? Why did she have the body dug up, then?"
"That I don't know. An idea that Weldon, damn his meddling, must have put into her head. Ah, man, it's his luck that we haven't him here today."
"The fool left, eh? She had tangled his brain in a fog yesterday. Too clever, after all. A little too clever. But what a woman! I'm going to have one glance at her."
He crossed to the bed, and behind the curtain Weldon raised and leveled his revolvers. He saw the big fellow draw back the sheet. Almost instantly he replaced it.
"I thought I was past shudders, Watts," he said, "but she's like a white statue of a child. So cold, poor girl. Tush, I'll be sentimental. But there was a woman.
To what room do we go?
Watts asked anxiously.
Are you funking it?
No, no. Only I want a little haste. I can't hold out forever. What if Weldon should make up his mind to come back?
As for Weldon, I'll handle that young man when I meet him. As for the room, this is the place.
This place?
This is it. The big fellow turned as he spoke to a spot on the wall opposite the foot of the bed.
Are you sure? Asked the doctor.
Didn't I help the old general hide his money in the two places?
Ah, yes, Henry Watts said. And how could he have trusted you so implicitly?
He had his weak places. He was growing old. He liked to feel that he had the ability to pick out men and make them faithful.
He knew you were wanted for murder even at the time.
That was what pleased him all the more, that he could trust me, even though I had murdered others. And he was right, after all. I had no share in the killing.
You? Henry Watts stammered in anger. It was you who put the first thought in my mind.
You would have had the same thought before long, however. Once a poisoner, always a poisoner. Ah, here we are.
There was an audible creaking, and a stone fell out from the wall and sagged on a hinge. The big man reached into the aperture and drew out a considerable bundle wrapped in cloth. He opened the cloth. The doctor crowded near.
Is it right? Henry Watts gasped. Is it right?
Of course it's right, said the big man. There's more than 400,000 in this little parcel. Do you wonder that I was willing to pay 50,000 to get back across the border? And she's so keen to help me across? I must give you the credit for that, though. 50 for 400. Good odds, I'd call that.
Dickinson then realized Weldon. Aye, no other man had quite such shoulders, such a look of a tiger about him.
Not quite 8 to 1,
the doctor said in an ugly voice, his breath drawn in with a sort of gasp of greed and hunger.
I suppose half of that goes to me as before?
To my little Henry, to my dear old friend who has stayed so close to the nest to hatch this egg for us?
Dickinson said.
Of course you have to have a share, as great a share as any man could have of anything. And here it is for you, Henry, with all my heart behind it.
His movement was so sudden and so totally unexpected that Weldon saw only a flash. The doctor stepped back against the wall, his hands clutching his breast. The flash gleamed again, and Weldon distinctly heard the thud of the hand driven home as the blade of the knife was buried deep in the body of Dr. Henry Watts. The doctor sagged to his knees, pawed oddly at the air as though he were drowning and trying to get to the surface of water. Then he collapsed on his face. He had not made a sound. Dickinson turned the body on its back, the while wiping his knife on the doctor's coat, and then fumbled at the heart of the fallen man. And at that moment, Weldon pushed the curtain aside and walked stealthily forward across the room, past the yawning gap of the open door in the wall. Chapter 42
So, Dickinson said and rose to his feet, and there's the end of a very wise man. He also was bound to have a little share for himself. And he laughed, an incredible sound in the ears of Weldon. That laughter had not yet ended on Dickinson's lips when he whirled as a dancer spins. The least creak of the floor had reached his ears, or the slightest whisper of moving cloth. He whirled, and as he whirled, he cast his knife at Weldon. It was a ponderous buoy, and the loaded handle struck Weldon fairly between the eyes. He fired with both guns at the same instant, but even as he fired, he knew that he had missed. Then a human avalanche struck him and crushed him to the floor. They spun over and over,
stars shooting and blossoming like red flowers before the eyes of Weldon as he vaguely fumbled at the other. From lumber camps to range fires, he had closed man to man with the strongest, but never had he felt such a body as this, supple and incredibly hard like steel cable. The guns were gone from his hands. They had fallen as he fell. Now in their rolling course, the two men crashed against the wall, Weldon on the inside receiving the full shock. And yet he was not stunned by it. He felt blood spring hot from the back of his head. Blood, too, ran down across his eyes, but his head was clear once more, and his strength was his own. A stranglehold was clamped across his throat. He reached up and broke it as if it had been a straw. Bending his head into the hollow of Dickinson's shoulder, he laid his arms about the other and exerted all his might. Aye, almost for the first time he used his full power and felt the back of the big man arch out against the restraint. Dickinson himself was fumbling to gain that stranglehold again, and the tips of his fingers tore at the throat of Weldon like iron hooks. But a shudder was beginning in the body of the criminal. There was a gasping curse, and he collapsed against Weldon. Another twist, and Weldon was on top. A fist of iron struck at him, and like iron, it glanced across his head, half stunning him. What had been the black mask of Dickinson became a large blur, and for the center of that blur Weldon struck once, and felt his knuckles grind against flesh, and through flesh to the bone. He struck again with terrific power. Dickinson lay as limp as a weed. So, his head clearing again, Weldon turned that great sack of a body upon its face, and gathered the wrists in the small of the back. And wiping the blood from his face, he looked up. She stood beside him, a ghostly form in white, with the glitter of a poised revolver in her hand. She had been there how long? Ready to strike if there were a need, but coldly judicial as a man. She whirled away now, and came back with a length of curtain cord. With that, Weldon secured his man, hand and foot. He lifted the burden of Dickinson into a chair. Helen O'Malley had opened the shutters of the room, and the bright daylight flooded in as Dickinson opened his eyes. Weldon tore the mask from the face. A gash beneath the eye and a bruise along the jaw told where the two blows had gone home. But in spite of those stunning strokes, Dickinson's mind was clear again.
"The best man fights once too often," he said calmly. "You win, my dear girl. That fool of a Watts. I should have known that his mixture couldn't be trusted."
"Not this time," the girl said quietly. "It took a life, but by the grace of chance, it was not my life." She added, "But still you would have lost. He was still here, waiting for you."
Dickinson turned a blazing eye on Weldon. Gradually the fire died away from his glance.
"Fairly beaten," he said at last, "and I'll fairly hang. But it took a man to break me down, and a woman. The first two of either breed that I've met in my trip around the world."
Chapter 43 The old servant, Doggett, brought up the sheriff. Weldon, his face swollen and bandaged, watched Big Jim Dickinson led away. Aunt Maggie had done that for him, muttering and mumbling with horror and excitement. The body of Henry Watts was gone likewise, and Weldon sent the negress to her mistress. "I want to see her for 5 minutes," Weldon had said. So Aunt Maggie left him, and Helen O'Malley came in hastily. There was color in her face. Her eyes were clear and bright. She stood at the door, hesitant, expectant, and smiling at him. But Weldon looked at her vaguely.
"Still you don't see?" she said.
He shook his head. "I'm not thinking very clearly," he said. "But I wanted to tell you that as soon as you can conveniently let me go, I have another thing to do."
"As hard a thing as what you've done here?"
"As hard? 1,000 times harder." He thought of Francesca LaGuardia and laughed bitterly.
"A thousand times harder," he repeated. "I have to find a woman's body. I have to find her soul, too, if there is one."
"There is a reward waiting for you,"
Helen O'Malley said. His mind wandered. "All the time you weren't an invalid," he said. "It was only play-acting?"
"Only play-acting. And now the reward."
He made an impatient gesture. "I've had my monthly pay. I want nothing else. Only to be free as soon as you can let me go. I don't want to be rude," he added heavily. "I'll stay here as long as you're afraid to be in the house without a man."
"No, no,"
Helen O'Malley said.
"I think I understand what you mean. And you're as free as the wind, only...
She looked helplessly at him.
"I want you to take a note with you, if you will," she said.
"Aye, gladly, of course." Then he added, with an effort at lightness, "Is it a testimonial?"
"Ah, no," she said. "It's an appeal."
He saw her sit down before him at the library table. She thought for an instant, and then her pen traced rapidly across the paper, "I am in desperate need." She could write no more. Then a great cry came rushing from the throat of Weldon. He caught the paper away and stared at it. The girl stood up, very white indeed, and faced him. "I'm trying to think," Weldon said thickly. "I'm trying to think how I..."
"See?"
Helen O'Malley said. She raised her hands to her head and fumbled a moment. Then the great mass of shining golden hair came away and left her head short-cropped. She looked suddenly younger, like a boy of a wonderful and delicate beauty.
"And then a black wig," she said.
He put out his big hands and laid them on her shoulders, and she in turn laid her hands upon his. "And the voice, too?"
"Oh, that was a shameful sham. There are things you eat that irritate the throat a little and make a horrible-sounding dry cough."
He drew her to the window. With the palm of his hand, he uncovered the short-cropped soft hair, and there was the face of dark Francesca LaGuardia, beautiful and wild. "Francesca," Weldon said.
"Helen,"
she corrected. "Never," Weldon said, "to me." Even knowing what he knew now, it still was hard for Weldon to follow the course of events until she took him through the whole strange history, step by step. There had been the death of her father, not terribly sudden, but odd in many circumstances, so that it haunted her. And there had been the original suggestion made by Dr. Henry Watts that perhaps the absence of money from the house indicated a theft, that and the open wall pocket in the cellar. The disappearance of Dickinson had been a most suspicious circumstance in a way, though explainable in many lights, for the hounds of the law had been hard on his traces, and he had perhaps been driven away by the fear of them, and the danger that not even the house of the general might be a secure retreat for him. As for the doctor, his conduct was easily explained. It was truly for his health that he had come from the east to the west. Fear of throat trouble had driven him, throat trouble consisting of a hempen noose around the neck, for he had a record in another state. He had come here and found a haven with the open-handed general, and put up a cottage on the general's land. But as the years drifted, the old passion had come back on him. Not for nothing had he made to Weldon his speech in admiration of the old poisoners. Then Dickinson came and put the thought strongly in his mind. Dickinson himself had intimate knowledge of every architectural secret in the house. He knew the two wall pockets. He could guess that when the general sold the majority of his property,
he would be placing the cash in those hiding places, forgetful that a secret known to two has no value. So the worthy doctor had poisoned his friend and benefactor, and the same night of the death he and Dickinson had visited the cellar. There they looted one portion of the general's wealth, but the other portion was in the girl's own room. They would wait till the morrow for that. Before the morrow, Dickinson had fled south for his life, only promising the doctor that he would return when he could get the remainder of the spoils. The worthy doctor then, after a year, received a covert message from Dickinson that he was held for high ransom, held openly by the arch-scoundrel of San Trinidad, Miguel Cabrero. The doctor was in a dreadful quandary. He thought at once of appealing to Joram, the smuggler, of whom he knew by chance, but then the doctor was tormented by doubts, apparently. So he went to Helen O'Malley and confided in her. The thief who had rifled the wealth of her father was in San Trinidad. His name was Dickinson. He was trying to get to this side of the border. Once here, he would, of course, come back to the house to complete its plundering. How could they keep tab upon his movements? The girl herself made the answering suggestion. She had done more than her share in school theatricals. Her veins were full of the wild O'Malley blood. What if she stepped into a new role, joined the ranks of the smugglers, became aware of all their plans? Joram surely would sooner or later attempt to rescue Dickinson. When he did it, she would know. And then she and the doctor would strive to arrange a trap in which to catch the thief on his return. That was all her motive as she entered the affair. She had spent her savings on one great venture, the long gray car, which she stored at the house of the doctor. Then from that place, it was easy to return to her house, take off the black wig, remove the darkening from her brows, place on her head the wig made of her own hair. Only one person need be let into the secret partially. That was Aunt Maggie. But then the tale became more dangerous and complicated. Twice men were found in the house. The later explanation of this was simple. Cabrero had learned some hint from Dickinson, and he had sent on a pair of his rogues at odd times to examine the house. The girl, frightened, wanted the fighting man to protect her. The doctor, baffled, agreed, and so Weldon was hired. And his coming brought the place security. Too much security to suit the doctor. But still he was hounded by the fear that when Dickinson returned, he would not play fair, but would make a private visit to the house. In fact, all that finally drove Dickinson directly to him was the belief of the master criminal that it would be necessary to murder the girl before looting her room, and therefore the doctor had given the cook a tablet to drop into the hot milk of the morning's drink. So that story was told, not all at once, but in many installments, of which the last ended when Weldon and his wife stood on the prow of a liner, listening to the crashing of the bow wave, roaring, dying away, and roaring again. "But why was it necessary for you to be an invalid?" he asked her.
"How else was I to stay awake all night on smuggling raids, and then stay in bed most of the day?"
she asked him, "particularly after you came to Mount Guard." "And every day you slept there, knowing that there was a hole in the wall through which they might come?"
"I had a bell that would bring you, and if you came, I was not afraid of an army."
"And one more thing."
"Yes?"
"Is Francesca really dead, or will she come to life again?" She was silent for a long time. He almost thought that she had not heard him. At last she said,
"If you ever grow tired of me, then perhaps."
The End. This concludes the reading of The Brass Man, a Western story by Max Brand, copyright 1928 by Street and Smith Publications, Incorporated. Copyright renewed 1956 by Dorothy Faust. Copyright 2014 by Golden West Literary Agency for restored material. This book was read by Traber Burns, a member of SAG-AFTRA. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Golden West Literary Agency and was produced in 2018 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.